Shalom, I'm Ryan White of Rooted in Torah Ministries, and this is part three of the Righteousness and Justice, part of the whole series of the Gospel of the Suffering Servant. So in this last two parts, we were developing the concept of righteousness and justice, which, remember, that is that henditis, that is the combination of the two, which is talking about something greater, which is the concept of social justice, of doing what is right by your brother, that is the duty of us in the kingdom, and of course that is the work of Messiah ultimately, and Messiah works through us in order to do that as well. So this last part here, and the righteousness and justice part, is I want to take apart those words. Instead of looking at them combined, let's look at them as individual words. So we're going to ask the question, what is biblical righteousness? What is biblical justice or biblical judgment? Because that word mishpat can either be judgment or it could be translated as justice, and often is translated either way, depending on how the translators want to throw it in there. So let's look at some examples. We're first going to look at righteousness. Let's look at some biblical examples of righteousness and see if these fit our theological conception of the concept of righteousness. The first one I want to bring to attention is Genesis 38, verse 24. It says, "Now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, 'Your daughter-in-law, Tamar, has played the harlot, and behold, she is with child by harlotry.' And Judah says, 'Bring her out and let her be burned.' And it was that while she was being brought out, that she was sent to her father-in-law, saying, 'See, I am with child by the man to whom these belong.' And she said, 'Please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff these are.' And Judah recognizes them and said, 'She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah.'" Interesting. Tamar acted in a righteous manner by dressing up like a harlot and seducing Judah to have intercourse outside of marriage. Does that fit our theological conception of the term righteousness? That's probably, I would say, probably one of the farthest things that I would have ever considered righteousness to be, and yet here it is in the text very clearly. Judah considers her to be more righteous. Maybe that's because we need to readjust our concept of what righteousness is, okay? There's a lot of terms in the scripture that for us are going to make a lot more sense when we start to understand them through the terms what the terms actually mean, instead of trying to look at them through what we've brought out these terms to mean. Let's go to 2 Peter 2, verse 6 through 7. It says, "And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes and having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, so right there it's calling Lot a righteous man, a tzaddik. Is Lot, did he fit our definition? I mean, isn't this the guy who basically was greedy and took the best part of the land from Abraham, who split his camp from Abraham, and who ultimately ended up getting drunk and having intercourse with his own daughters? This guy is righteous? Let's go to Daniel 4, verse 27. This is where Nebuchadnezzar, remember, he has this dream where God is going to, he turns him into a beast, a wild beast here. And, of course, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't want this to happen, so he's asking Daniel, how do I avert this? And Daniel says, "Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by doing righteousness, and from your iniquity by showing mercy to the poor, in case there might be, or in order that your prosperity would be prolonged." So, doing righteousness, this wicked king, this idolater, he was not a worshiper of Yahweh. And yet, if he broke away by doing righteousness and by doing mercy to the poor, he could avert the penalty of the punishment of what his deeds were piling up to become. Deuteronomy 6, verse 25, what does it say about the Torah? It says, and this will be righteousness for us if we carefully observe all of this commandment before Yahweh, our Elohim, just as he commanded us. So keeping the Torah is righteousness. Deuteronomy 25, verse 1, we read that last half hour, that term righteousness being used in a legal dispute. The judge decides between the two, declares one to be righteous and the other one to be wicked. And then Romans 4, verse 23 through 25, speaking of Abraham, and now, not for his sake only was it written that it was credited to him, but for our sake also, whom it is credited, as those who believe in him, who are raised in Yeshua our Messiah from the dead. And he was delivered over because of our transgressions and was raised for our justification. Right? And if you go up a little bit, that's where Abraham was accredited righteousness because of his belief. So there we have a kind of a sampling of some of the usages of righteousness. Now, how do we fit these all together? Let's go to Isaiah chapter 32, verse 16 and 17. It says, then justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness will abide in the fertile field. So justice and righteousness, right? The effect of righteousness will be peace, shalom, and the result of righteousness, quietness and trust forever. So righteousness, the effect of righteousness, whatever righteousness is, what it causes is shalom, translated here as peace. Okay? Now, the problem is, and the reason why I use shalom is because peace is a terrible translation of shalom in today's culture, what peace means today. For us today, peace just means there's no more violence. Everybody wants peace in the Middle East, which means a two-state solution with Israel. But will that establish biblical shalom? No, that will not establish biblical shalom, because there's still a people who are oppressing another people. Hamas is still launching rockets into Israel. The Muslims are still wanting to wholesale slaughter of the Jewish people. There cannot be a peace in the Middle East until shalom is established, which shalom is a wholeness. It's a completeness. It means ultimately what you could bring it down to is the peaceful and prosperous existence of everyone. It restores things back to the way that they should be. Okay? So if you stop fighting, if there's a rebel group and the rebellion is squashed, does that mean that there's peace? No, because that rebellious group oftentimes rose up because of some sort of oppression going on. And so you have to fix the oppression. You have to right the wrongs, put things back in their right order. So righteousness, the Hebrew term righteousness, it is comprehensively relational. You'll always see this in relationship to something. It's never used as a private attribute that one individual can have on his or her own, independent of another party. Right? There always has to be some sort of a relationship going on. Righteous Lot. Righteous in relationship to what? Well, when we read that, it was righteous in relationship to the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Tamar was more righteous than Judah. So ultimately, at its heart, what righteousness means is it's fulfilling the demands of a relationship. Think about that. Tamar was more righteous than Judah. Why? Because the demands of the relationship was that she was married to his oldest son. And when his oldest son died without giving her a son, what is the major issue? She has no son, and therefore there's no inheritance that goes through her. She has no protection. She has no man to take care of her. So, according to the laws of the Levirate marriage, the younger brother is supposed to do that. And he tried to, except for it says that he was wicked and he spilled his seed on the ground. Why was that a wicked act? Now, I'm going to tell you right off the bat, it has nothing to do with the concept of self-pleasuring, okay? The problem with that is if Onan, I think his name was Onan, but anyways, if the oldest brother died, what does that put the youngest brother as? That puts him as the rightful successor of the house. He is now the eldest. He now gets the double portion inheritance. And so now when Judah dies, instead of the oldest son getting two portions and the middle son getting one portion and the youngest son getting one portion, now it would, if nothing else happens, now that son, he's going to receive a double portion of what's left there, right? And so he would have gained a lot more wealth because of this. Now, if he would have given Tamar a son, what would have happened? Well, now that son would have received the double portion inheritance, and Onan is right back to receiving only 25% of the estate instead of 66% of the estate. Does that make a little bit more sense now why Yahweh killed him over this? Because instead of being his brother's keeper, he was refusing to do the duty so that he could become wealthy because of this. And after that, Judah becomes afraid that this youngest son is going to die, which turns the relationship with Tamar sour. She's being oppressed. She was supposed to be the mother of a child who received 50% of his estate, which would take care of her. But now she does not get that, receive that portion because of this son. And so there was a relationship there that was destroyed. There was no shalom there in that relationship. So by her going out and playing the harlot, she is in fact fulfilling the demands of the relationship. She's restoring the shalom, so restoring things to how they should have been, which was she has a son that receives the inheritance. Okay? Does that make more sense now that we understand righteousness in those terms? The other thing to notice with righteousness is that it's often used in covenantal context. Okay? So when we look at, there's a lot of different words here that are associated with righteousness itself and what it does. Okay? And so how I see this, or how I put this together in my mind is this. You've got two different spheres, right? Over here we'll say is the evil sphere, and over here is the righteous sphere, right? The judge decides between the two. This is all the bad stuff that happens. This is sin. This is disorder. This is inequality. This is poverty, suffering, death, all of these things. And over here is shalom. This is the way that things are supposed to be. You've got righteousness, equity, salvation, justification, uprightness. That's the way things are supposed to be. So how do you go from over here, all the bad stuff, to over here? Well, that's where the Hebrew uses such words as righteous deeds, right? Being more righteous than someone else. Chesed, or mercy, or loving kindness, as it's often translated as. Redemption, restoring back to shalom, restoring the honor and the righteousness there. Justifying, justification, all those things. Justice and judgment, all those things are to put us in that sphere of shalom, of righteousness, a state of justification, if you will. And so that's the Hebrew concept of righteousness. That's what we should strive towards with that. Now, let's look at justice, because this is very important. Unfortunately, today we have a warped sense of what justice is, because our system, and I'm speaking as an American. If you're not in America, I don't know how your justice system works. I'm sorry. But here in America, our justice system is no longer based on the biblical concept of justice. There's different types of justice. There's restorative justice. The major things are restorative justice and retributive justice. Justice that's about restoring things, or justice that's about revenge, about getting back, about making someone pay for what they did. Now, which one of those two is what biblical justice is all about? It is restorative justice. Yahweh acts to restore, not in retribution. Now, sometimes there is wrath and retribution, but why is that? Because sometimes that's what it takes to restore back to shalom, okay? God's justice is not based on merit, it's based on need, right? Remember, we were talking about when someone cries out, God rescues him. It's that way that God arrives at in order to rescue them and pronounce someone, God's justice isn't about pronouncing someone guilty or innocent. It's about aiding those that are in distress, about restoring them to their former level of honor, restoring them to protection, to financial protection, to a state that they can exist peacefully and prosperously. That's what God's justice is based on. And yeah, sometimes that does require the death of the oppressor, especially when they're in a state of rebellion, when they don't want they don't want to restore the relationship. That's what open rebellion is. It's that guy's picking up sticks that was high-handed. He said, "God, I know your laws. I don't care about them. I want to do what I want to do." There was no desire for relationship there. He had lost that, and thus he had to be put to death. Whereas David did some horrible things. And yet, what did David do? He did things deserving of death, in fact. And yet, David had a humble and contrite heart. He did not want to destroy that relationship with Yahweh. When he realized what he had done wrong, because if you look at it, David didn't even realize what he did wrong, which seems absurd to us being, just regular people, but he was a king in the ancient Near East. Kings in the ancient Near East, if they saw a woman they wanted, it didn't matter. They would take her. And it took the prophet Nathan to make up this story, to give him a parable for him to realize what he had actually done wrong. David didn't even realize that he was in the wrong. But when he did, what did he do? He went and he restored that relationship. He did restorative justice. He tried to do what was right. He cried out to Yahweh. And I mean, obviously, he couldn't restore the relationship with the man he had killed, but he repented before Yahweh because of that. Now, I want you to look at Deuteronomy 25, verse 1 through 3 this time. We're going to look at a little bit more context here, and we're going to see what it is that defines how justice is rendered according to the Torah. And it reads, "If there is dispute between men and they go to court, the judge decides their case, and they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will make him lie down and be beaten in his presence." Now, why is that? Because the beating wasn't about pain and suffering. The beating ultimately is about shaming. "With the number of stripes according to his wickedness, he may beat him 40 times, but no more, so that he does not beat him with many more stripes than these, and your brother is not degraded in your eyes." So even with the punishment, there's a maintaining of dignity with the person. You can beat them, but you can't beat them so many times that they're going to be degraded and be shamed beyond, beyond the point that they're being shamed to with their punishment, shamed to the point where they're broken, right? And think about this. What is the problem with the American justice system? We take a criminal and we say, "Oh, you've done this. Let me look up the law code. This says 3 to 5 years sentence." So then the judge gets to decide, is it 3 years? Is it 5 years? Is it this or that? And then they go to jail. What does jail do to a person? Does it make them feel worthy? Does it make them feel like they've actually paid off their crime, that they've actually fixed the problem? No, the problem is still there. You know, you look at a drunk driver who went out and killed someone's child. They go to jail, yeah, but the problem is not solved. There's still a broken heart. There's broken down relationship. And now this person goes to jail. Does it do anything for them? Maybe now they're too scared to go out drinking and driving again. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying there's no merit to the system at all. But what does it do to that person? Ultimately, it degrades them. It demoralizes them. And sometimes people do go to jail and they do change. But if you look at overall what happens, a lot of times they just end up in jail again because our system isn't designed to actually rehabilitate the criminals. It's just to have them pay their debt to Lady Justice, which, by the way, was a pagan god. That's what our system is based on, is paying our debt to justice. It's not about restoring anything. It's about just paying the debt. That's not what biblical justice is on. He says that you do that in the judge's presence in order, and you don't do it to the point where he's not degraded, to the point where it breaks him down and demoralizes him. So let's look at some examples in the Torah of restorative justice. The first one is the case of the goring ox. And this is one of my favorite examples to go to because this really teaches us a lot of interesting things here about the Torah. This is in Exodus 21, verse 29. If, it says, however, an ox previously is in the habit of goring and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. But if the ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give the redemption of his life, whatever is demanded of him. Very interesting case here. First off, let's analyze this. First off, what is going on here? This person did something wrong, and now he is deserving of death, right? An ox gored him. What if it was a donkey that stomped him to death, and this donkey was in the habit of stomping people? What if it was a vicious dog that mauled him, and the owner knew that this dog mauled him? Well, according to the letter of the law, he should be free, right? Because there's nothing in the Torah that says anything about the dog. It's only about the ox. No. We are misunderstanding the Torah if we were to think in that manner. You see, the Torah was never meant to be 613 commandments. It's not a checklist that I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this. Oh, it says I can do this, and there's a loophole. Right? In the land of Israel today, this year they're celebrating the Shemitah year. And in a news article, guess what I was reading? Well, the Shemitah year says that you shall let the land lie fallow. But if you're growing your crops on water, on hydroponics, this law does not apply to you. Really? Did God really need to list every single condition if it's on land, if it's on water, if you have it floating up in the sky? You know, no. The entire concept of the Torah is not based on the letter of the law, 613 lists, and as long as you can somehow loophole them, that you're okay. You should never, ever be able to do this. And this was the problem in the first century, by the way. They had a law called the prosbul, which was basically you're supposed to forgive the loans. Every 7 years, if you give out a loan, you're supposed to forgive the loan on the seventh year. So what did they do? I don't want to lose my money that I loaned to this guy. So what we're going to do is that when we create this loan, we're going to actually make this as an investment to the temple, and it's pledged to the temple, and so it circumvents the law. I don't remember the exact details, but basically they created a way to create a legal loophole so that you could continue to charge interest and to charge on a loan to your brother that the Torah very clearly says that you shall not do, that you shall forgive him that on the Shemitah year. The Torah was never, ever supposed to have loopholes. Why? Because we're misunderstanding. It's not Greco-Roman law. It's not a law code. It is righteous judgments. What the Torah was doing was teaching people how to make righteous judgments, so that when they are faced with a situation, they don't go, well, that the Torah doesn't specifically cover that, so you're good to go, brother. You're go ahead and keep on doing that, even though the Torah doesn't say that. No, you're supposed to learn the principle behind this. The principle is that this owner was aware that this person owned something that he was aware that was a hazard to society, and he allowed it to continue to be a hazard, and someone died as a result of it. And so this is what would we call this today? We would call this criminal negligence, I believe, would be the term. I'm not a lawyer. You can go ask a lawyer what exactly this is. Negligent homicide or something like that. And that's the basis for this. This person, because this person's laziness to take care of a problem that was a public health hazard, someone died. And so he is responsible up to the point of paying with his own life for it. And that's how we need to understand the Torah, is that it's not 613 commandments that are, you know, we can loophole as long as we can figure out a way around them. They're principles that are supposed to teach us how to be judges. We're supposed to learn how to judge people. That's, in fact, Paul writes, you know, you guys are supposed to judge angels. How much more the matters of this life? How do we learn how to judge? The Torah. Okay? So, this owner is to be stoned and shall be put to death. However, if a ransom is demanded, he shall redeem his life, buy back, restore the honor of his life by whatever is demanded of him. Okay? So, what does that mean? That means that I had an ox, and my ox killed your husband. Now, I could be put to death for this, but does that restore shalom? No, you've lost your husband now. You don't know how you're going to be able to feed yourself, to be able to feed your children, to take care of your farm. And so instead of putting me to death, I can redeem my life if you say, you know what, I know that this was bad on your part, but look, what's going to restore shalom is if you offer, if you pay me $200,000 so that I can feed my family. Or maybe, and it's, realize here, it's not talking about money. It says whatever is demanded of him. So this may be, I want you to work in my fields for the rest of your life. Or I want you to go climb out Mount Everest and for donations, for a charitable cause donation. Whatever is demanded, that is how you redeem your life. Interesting. What does God demand that we use to redeem our life? Yeshua, right? What Yeshua did redeems our life. It's not about a sum of money. You can't purchase yourself out of sin and death. It's about what Yeshua did, because that's what the Father asked for justification. I couldn't go out there and die unjustly and say, I'm dying for the sins of the world. That doesn't work. What Yahweh, who's the offended party here, what he demanded was his son, right? His son to go forth and restore the relationship through his death, his burial, and his resurrection. And so that is the concept that's coming right out of the Torah. The concept of restitution by whatever the offended party demands. Why? Because we're not about retribution, we're about restoration, right? That's what we've been talking about here, is that Yeshua came not to fulfill the demands of an angry God, but to restore us and restore the honor of the Father so that we could be restored back to relationship with him. It's about restorative justice, not about angry, vindictive judgment and retribution. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back. Shalom, welcome back. The next verse we want to look at for restorative justice is restitution from stealing. And you see this, it's very common throughout the scripture, but for example, Exodus 22, verse 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it and sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for an ox or 4 sheep for a sheep. Very, very clearly, you see here, the penalty for stealing isn't about retribution. It's not about putting him in jail. It's simply making restoration. He stole something that didn't belong to him, so he pays back 4 sheep or double it. You know, different areas, different, depending on what it is, it's different. And that's very different from the laws of the ancient Near East, because in those laws, a lot of the times this guy would be put to death or his hand would be cut off or something like that. And yet, God actually, the Torah is actually one of the most lenient law codes on thieving, on stealing. Why is that? Who's generally the person stealing? It's someone who's already in need, right? And so there's already a basis there. Now think about this too, because this is where we start to get into slavery, which is something that people like to make fun of the Bible for and talk about how unjust God is because of slavery. If a man steals something, let's say he stole the sheep because he was hungry and he slaughtered it and he ate it, he probably doesn't have 4 sheep to make restitution for it, does he? So what does he do? Well, he has to sell himself as a slave to pay off the debt that he owes. So now he sells himself to someone. Now, who is this someone? Well, it's someone who's rich enough to be able to afford to pay off this guy's debt to another person. He's obviously wealthy and well-to-do. And so now you work as a slave for him for however many days, months, years it takes to pay off that debt that you owe for your crime, up to the point of 7 years, right? And once you go out, and realize, during this, if you read in Deuteronomy, it talks about you have to maintain the dignity of your slaves, of your servants. You couldn't treat them, like human trash. They were maintained with dignity. So you have dignity there. You're actually working to pay off your debt instead of having someone else pay it off for you, which is something that degrades a person when they can't pay for their own way, which is one of the major problems with our current system of our welfare system. It degrades the individual because they're no longer feeling a sense of accomplishment that I earned this. It's now just the government gave it to me for free. And that's why there's so much rampant abuse within the system. So he goes and he's working for someone who's successful. So now he gets to see someone who's successful and learn their successful work habits instead of going to a prison and being around a bunch of other criminals and basically just learning how to become a better criminal. He's rehabilitated. He's restored. Once he's done, everyone's happy. He now has been taught how to be successful. And actually, Deuteronomy says that he shall go out with things. You're to give him stuff. You don't just kick him out the door. And the person who was stolen from now, instead of having one sheep, he has four sheep or whatever was stolen, right? So everybody's happy. There's a restoration of relationship. Whereas if someone went out in today's society and they stole something from you and they used it, if they stole, what was that guy? Madoff, right? He stole all these people's money, right? Millions and billions of dollars, however much it was. He goes to jail, right? When he gets out of jail, is the relationship restored? No. He's basically been a criminal, living around criminals. I don't know what his situation is exactly. But all the people who he's stolen from, they don't have anything now. They're out of their money. There's no shalom. There's no restoration of relationship. Exodus 22, verse 16. This is a difficult one for a lot of people. It says, when a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay the dowry for her to be his wife. If the father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. Right? Now, first off, this is not talking about rape. There's a different context when it's talking about rape. But even if it was, let's say even if it was, right? What is going on here? This woman has been, for whatever reason, whether it was through rape or whether it was seduction, for whatever reason, he seduces her. She's no longer a virgin. What happens now? Well, in that culture, she was no longer a desirable bride. In that culture, you didn't go out and marry someone who was no longer a virgin. In fact, there's one of the commands in the Torah is if the girl is not a virgin and the husband proves it, then she's put to death because of it. Right, so now no one wants to marry her, and so now her dowry goes down, right? Instead of having a large dowry, she's going to have a relatively small dowry because no one wants to marry her. Her life would be ruined. She would not be able to marry. She would not. Her father essentially would have to support her for the rest of her life. There would be no shalom here, even if they put this guy to death. Putting him to death doesn't solve the fact that she's no longer a virgin, that no one wants to marry her anymore. That now her father has to support her. So now it says that if he does this, he has to pay the dowry, which would be whatever her father sets for her, which might make him have to go be a slave to work it off, right? And now she's his wife. And if you look at some of the other verses, it talks about that he is never allowed to divorce her. So now, because he acted dishonorably towards her, she can shame him all day long, and he can't divorce her. Very interesting context there, right? Exodus 23, verse 2 through 3 says, you shall not follow the masses to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside the multitude in order to pervert justice, nor shall you be partial to the poor man in his dispute. So you cannot follow the crowd. This isn't about what the crowd wants. This is about maintaining justice. And you cannot pervert justice, which is what happened with Yeshua. They followed the crowd and they perverted justice. That's what Pilate did. He's very guilty of violating this command right here. He followed the crowd and he perverted justice. Right? Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. You don't take from the rich just to give to the poor just because he accused the rich. You determine what actually happened and you determine how to restore shalom to the situation. Leviticus 19, verse 15. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you shall judge your neighbor fairly. So we should judge our neighbor, right? Eye for an eye, right? The whole context of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, you've got to realize in the ancient Near East, here's how it went. If I was and they had different, in other nations, they had other classes, right? They had an upper class and they had a lower class and then they had a slave class. If a slave class, if he wronged an upper class person, guess what happened to him? They killed him, right? But in the same situation, if it was the rich man doing something to the poor man, guess what happened? He might pay him like 10 cents or something like that, right? It was justice based on your classes. Your class of citizenry, right? In Leviticus 24, verse 16 through 22, if you read the entire context here, it all started with a scenario where a woman's, the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian, i.e. someone who might be thought of as second class, he wronged someone. And so it shows that it doesn't matter what class of citizen you are, you still have equal, it doesn't matter who you are, equal punishment. And see, we always look at it as you must do fracture, you must do eye for eye, you must do tooth for tooth. No, that's not the scenario. Remember, this is all teaching us how to judge. We can use what we had just read earlier about the ox to realize you could demand that, but you could also demand a redemption for his eye, redemption for his tooth, right? So maybe the value of an eye is $50,000. So you say, you know, you poked out my eye, but if I poke out your eye, what good does that do? Now we're both only have one eye. Instead, now I have to take a pay cut because I can't work as hard. I want you to pay the difference. I want you to pay the $50,000 or $200,000 or whatever it is. However, maybe you were going around poking out everyone's eye because you were Bill Gates and you could just afford $50,000, $50,000, $50,000. Now I could say, look, there is something wrong with you. We're going to go ahead and poke your eye out so you can't even see to be able to poke someone else's eye out. All right, so it's that idea of a limitation. This is the max you can do, right? You poked out my eye. I can't demand you to be put to death, even if you were a slave and I'm a rich man, right? You poked out my eye. The most I can do is have your eye poked out. Okay, does that make sense? I hope that makes sense to you. That's the restorative justice being seen there. So, as I talked about before, when I talked about honor and shame, honor and shame is how most of the world sees things. They don't see things through the American justice system. So I'm going to read to you an excerpt from a book. The book is called Recovering the Scandal of the Cross. I don't remember the author of it. But it's a really interesting read. And so he's talking about there's a Japanese church leader who's having a difficult time with a missionary's standard explanation of why Yeshua had to die. What he was taught in America about why Yeshua had to die, he could not explain to these Japanese church leaders. They didn't understand it. The missionary explained that Yeshua died in order to pay the penalty for our sins that are required by God. Well, the Japanese church leader responded, to be honest, I do not find that explanation satisfactory. To them, that didn't matter. That paying the penalty was inconsequential. To them, it was all about honor and shame, right? They're shamed because of their sins. And so he continues to write, a tragic accident provided the missionary with his first clues as to why the common penal substitution explanation of atonement, so clear and logical in the Western missionaries, did not satisfy this Japanese church leader. A young man from the congregation was driving a company truck and accidentally hit and killed two women walking across the road. The police and court demonstrated more concern for the relationships and the people's responses rather than the written code. Now remember, the Japanese culture is based on honor and shame. It's a lot closer to the biblical culture than our Western Greek culture. They handled the case in a markedly different way than the American legal process. The young man immediately confessed that the accident was his fault because he was going too fast. The judge put him in custody, but released him to attend the funeral of the two women who were killed. The judge attended the funerals also and carefully observed not only how the young man behaved, but how the families responded to him. In the meantime, the police carefully investigated and exonerated the young man. They said he could not have been going as fast as he reported. They discovered that the company truck had a steering defect, and the young man was let out of jail to do public service for the rest of the year, and then he was considered released and fully rehabilitated. Later on, the missionaries were having a discussion, discussion on the concept of justice in Japan with a group of his Japanese colleagues, and he asked them, "What is justice?" And they discuss it among themselves, and they respond, "Justice is whatever the judge says it is." In the American justice system, the Western image of justice is what? It's Lady Justinia. It's justice with a bandage, a blindfold wrapped around her eyes. She's blind, holding up scales. It's an impartial weighing of someone's guilt and innocence based on the evidence and a standard set of laws. In contrast to that, though, the Japanese culture, it's based on a male judge. If they were to have an image of this, instead of a blindfolded woman holding up scales, it's a judge with his eyes wide open, observing the situation and doing whatever he can do to best preserve human relationships, right? The Japanese, they do have imprisonment, but they use that as a shaming technique in order to exclude people from society. That's how they work. Let's look at how God's justice system works. In Exodus 23, verse 6 through 8, it reads, "You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor and their lawsuits. Keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent and those in the right. For I will not acquit the guilty. You shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the official and subverts the cause of those that are in the right or are righteous." Right? That's God's basis of justice. He does not let you kill the innocent or those in the right. If God's keeping with the Torah, he could not have put Yeshua to death, because his own Torah says, "You shall not kill the innocent or those in the right." God legally could not put Yeshua to death according to the Torah. It says, "You shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the officials." And yet here American justice is with her scales up and her sword in her hand and a blindfold around her eyes. Because to us, justice needs to be blind in order to be fair. But according to the scriptures, bribing blinds them. They're supposed to have their eyes open so that they can determine who acted righteously and how to righteously restore the situation. Think about the parable. The master of the field, right? And he goes out and he hires a bunch of people to do work. And then a little bit later, he hires more people to do work. And then the last hour of the day, he hires more people to do work. And he had promised them one mina of silver. I don't remember what the exact thing was, right? He promised them all the same amount. And when he goes to pay them out, what happens? The people who've been there working all day, where's my justice? It's not about the American concept of blind justice. It's about doing what is right by the people. He promised them something, he's going to pay them according to what is right, what he promised them. It's all about that relationship that is there, right? Now, is God's forgiveness in Scripture, do we see in Scripture that his forgiveness is based on only if the penalty is paid? Or do we see people who get forgiven without the penalty being paid? David is a prime example. David did not, he deserved death. And yes, his son did die, but he didn't have to pay that penalty, right? That's the whole concept of Yahweh's justice system is about restoring the relationship, doing what is necessary to restore those relationships back together. So let's go back and let's connect this with Isaiah 53 before we end here. What do we see there? We see in Isaiah 53 the people saying, "We ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted." We, the people, we thought that it was God punishing him. But who really was it? It was us. It was because of what we were doing. We had a perversion of justice, and which is exactly what it says In verse 8, by a perversion of justice, he was taken away. It wasn't to satisfy the demands of blind justice. It was because of a perversion of justice that Yeshua is led away into his death, right? The suffering servant of Isaiah, how is he portrayed? Is it justice being served, or is it injustice? No, it's injustice. That's the eyes that we need to look through this. And this is how we need to be able to change our perspective on things, is that God is in the business of restoring the relationships. And that's what Yeshua came to do, is to restore the relationships. We are restored to the Father because Yeshua's work was there to restore us. What is the New Testament? How does it portray justice being in its courtrooms? Where do we see? We see John the Baptist. Was he put to death over in a just manner? No. He was executed because on the whim of some girl who was dancing pleased King Herod. Yeshua, did he receive justice at his trial? No, it was a complete kangaroo court. They arrested him at night. They held the trial at night. Even Pontius Pilate was like, this is nonsense, right? And if you ever studied Pilate, he was not a good guy, right? Pilate was very wicked. If you read the historical writings, he was absurdly wicked. And yet even he was like, I find no fault in this guy. And yet, even though he found no fault, he still gave the order to put him to death. So it was the perversion of justice. You look at James, right? How did James die? In the same manner, a perversion of justice. Throughout the New Testament, it's over and over and over shown that mankind's justice system is perverted. It's not according to the justice of the kingdom. And we see the result of this. The result of this was what? Was Yeshua's death. Hebrews 12, verse 3. If you read that, what does it say? It says, for he considered him who had endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you do not grow weary and lose heart. Right? Yeshua endured the shame of the cross by those who considered him, or by sinners against him. Right? It wasn't God who put him to death. It was the sinners. It was our action, our lack of justice put him to death. And so we need to be able to adjust our understanding of what justice is. Acts 22, verse 24, Acts 2, verse 22 through 24. Let's read that. It says, this man delivered over by a predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, right? God knew about the plan. It's not like mankind tricked God. We didn't pull a fast one on God. It was according to his plan. Why? He wanted to show his justice by raising him from the dead. A lesser example would be this. If you ever study the Roman games, right, the gladiator games, what was the thing that put the stop to them? It was a priest who got out there in the ring. Something happened, but he demanded that they stop, that they not kill this person, and it was, as a result, they killed this priest. And because of that, because they took some guy who was just out there trying to stop the violence, and they killed him, that's what the thing was, for them to realize how bad it was, and the emperor to put a stop to the gladiatorial games. How much more Yeshua, who was accused, he was suffered, and he died the most shameful death out of a complete perversion of justice. He was completely innocent. And yet we, in our perversion of our legal system back then, we put him to death. Humankind put him to death. But God shows his justice by doing what? By raising Yeshua from the dead. We already saw that in the last part. Multiple verses all through the book of Acts and through other books of the Bible that God raises Yeshua up from the dead. That's what he did. He allowed our unjust actions to kill him just so that he could show that he is not a God that's like that. He doesn't accept human sacrifice. He does. Now, don't get me wrong. There are verses that speak of Yeshua being a sacrifice, but it's metaphorical language. There was no human sacrifice that was ever allowed on the altar in Jerusalem. What the writers in the New Testament, when they use sacrificial language, they're trying to relate the concepts, because everyone, that's how people thought back then. You know, it's just like if I was trying to explain physics to someone, I might use, like the matter bouncing around, right? I might go to a pool table and show them how when I hit the ball, it bounces all around so you can see physics in action. That doesn't mean that atoms are literally that it's a metaphorical understanding. So Yeshua as a sacrifice is a metaphorical understanding. Now, this makes perfect sense, and this really helps us out, because if you've ever gone up to a Jewish person and said, did you know that Yeshua was the Passover lamb for you? What are they going to say? Can you tell me why Yeshua, why God would accept a human sacrifice when he never accepted a human sacrifice? Can you tell me why Yeshua didn't die on an altar? In fact, he died on a pagan cross. Why didn't he die in the temple? Why didn't they manipulate his blood on the altar if he was a sacrifice? All these things we've got to look at and realize that the language being used there is to understand that what Yeshua did is similar to the sacrifices. And so we can use that language, but that doesn't mean that God literally had him killed on the altar in order to do these things, right? It's the language of restoration, because that's what the sacrifices were all about. The sacrifices were about restoring the broken down relationship between a sinner and God. And that's exactly what Yeshua did. And so he did fulfill the sacrifices in that sense. But he himself, he was not literally a human sacrifice to God. I hope that makes sense to you. I hope you don't take offense to that, because this is one of those questions that we have to, this is a very valid question that I see asked a lot of the time. In fact, I asked it myself. I had to go and search out the answers to this. We need to be good Bereans. We need to search out these things and make sure that we can actually attest correctly to these things, because otherwise, what can happen? Well, we can be witnessing to someone and they don't get it because they understand the sacrifices in a different manner, right? All these things are very important. It's not to diminish in any way what Yeshua did. It's to build him up. It's to show and give proper context to the meaning of what he did. Yeshua did, what he did was absolutely necessary. It was absolutely necessary to restore our relationship with God so that God could show his justice by raising him up after we put him on a pagan altar and we put him to death, we being humanity. Acts 5, verse 31, God exalted him to his right hand as prince and savior. God fulfilled his promises to our children by raising up Yeshua. Romans 4, verse 25, Yeshua was raised for our justification, to declare us legally in the right. I hope that's making sense. What Yeshua did was set things in their right and proper order, right? Because of our actions, we brought shame to God. Because of Adam's actions, right? He brought shame to God. He brought shame to all of humanity. We became mortal because of this, because of these actions. And so Yeshua gets out there and he does what is necessary according to the plan of God. He surrenders himself completely to the injustice of the human, of the Greco-Roman, of the Sadducean justice system, and submits himself and allows himself, even though he could, I mean, if he would have wanted to in an instant, he could have stopped it, right? But he allowed this thing to happen in order to show us the depravity of our justice, what we do, what our actions, what our righteousness, if you will, is as filthy rags, to quote Isaiah. Our righteousness, the way that we set ourselves in right standing, is as filthy rags. We don't know what we're doing. We need the Torah. We need the Scriptures. We need the Holy Spirit in order to show us how to righteously live our lives, how to righteously keep the Torah. That doesn't diminish from the Torah. The Torah is necessary. But guess what? They had the Torah in the first century, and they still messed it up. They needed the Torah and the Spirit. They needed Yeshua. All of those things together, that's what brings wholeness. That's what brings completeness. That's what brings shalom That's what establishes righteousness and justice in our lives and in the universe, is what Yeshua did through the Torah, through the Holy Spirit. It's not one or the other. You have to have all of them. So I pray that this has been a blessing to you. In the next part, we're going to go in and we're going to look at a whole new area that still ties into all of this and builds on it, called the patron-client relationships, which will be very exciting. See you then. Shalom. Each and every day.